Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
New activation and upfront payment for 3-month plan required. Taxes and fees extra. Additional restrictions apply. See mintmobile.com for full terms.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Fantasy Writers Toolshed. I'm your host, Richie Billing, and today we've got a very interesting and insightful episode lined up for you with a look at day-to-day life in the medieval period, which is all designed to help inspire your fantasy tales. We're also going to have a look at the relationship between magic and science in the fantasy genre, which is an interesting one. And we're going to take a deep dive into getting book reviews. Now, not long ago, I launched something I've called the Book Blogger Survey. And I've been polling book reviewers all week on everything from what they look for in a review query to how many review requests they receive each week. And I'm going to be sharing some of those early results with you today, and they are very interesting indeed. I have learned a lot about how to approach book reviewers, how to work with them, what they're interested in, what they look for, and I think it's going to be very, very useful for you too. But before we dive in, just a quick reminder that if you enjoyed the show, please, please subscribe or follow us. It really does make a massive difference and provides a bit of confirmation that we're doing something right. Similarly, if you could leave a quick review on iTunes or whatever you listen to us on, that would be amazing too. It really does mean a lot. And if you think anyone you know would like this show, please share it with them. And if you'd like to show your support even more so and get some really cool things in exchange, please check out our Patreon page. I've been adding some really interesting things on there last week and the week before. So do head over, take a look, link in the description. And if you haven't already done so, why not join our writing community? It's a great place to congregate. Do so on Facebook and Discord. And you can share your work, get feedback, find beta readers, discuss ideas, get advice on them. We also share a lot of calls for submissions and resources, really interesting articles. And we celebrate each other's successes. And only last week, someone got a short story published after someone else in the group had helped them edit it, and also they let them know about this particular magazine or journal, sorry, that was accepting submissions. So yeah, please head over again. Just feel free to join us and you can chat away, and the link is in the description. Now back to today, and I'm delighted to welcome back to the Toolshed fantasy author and scientist Rachel Emmershaw for a chat about magic systems and science. Maybe one of the biggest conflicts in the fantasy genre is the relationship between science and magic systems. So often we see the patrons of each area at odds with one another, which for writers is a really good source for plots and characterization. But to help us make sense of it all, I'm delighted to be joined by fantasy author and neuroscientist, as well as host of the Science in Fantasy YouTube channel, Rachel Emmershaw. Rachel, how are you doing today?
I'm doing really well, Richie. I'm glad to be back.
Oh, no, it's nice to have you back. Last time we had a chat about the general influence that science has, the underestimated influence, let's say, on the fantasy genre.
We got very nerdy into that topic.
We did, yeah. And it's amazing to really, when you take a step back and you consider how much science, like, you do need a good bit of scientific insight, really, to build certain aspects of your world anyway.
Yeah, I'd say that when it comes to creating your fantasy worlds, it's all about research, and it doesn't have to. When we were at FantasyCon, there was a fantastic panel where they were talking about diversity, representation. In fact, there are lots of panels talking about this. And the point kept coming up that when it comes to these things, you need to do research. And someone made the comparison that they were like, well, if you're going to write about volcanoes in stories, then you would do your research. And it's the same thing when it comes to diversity. And I think it's the same thing when it's, you know, you want to write about any aspect of science, just do your research. If it's an area that's interested you enough to write a story about it, then delve into it.
Definitely. I think this is where the sort of that what the heart of the argument is that we're looking at today is magic versus science in the fantasy genre. Because when I promote my book, Fantasy Writers Handbook, and when you promote on social media, you do get people commenting. And one of the main things, strands that I talk about when selling this book is the difficulties of building a fantasy world, because you can easily get lost doing it. Mm-hmm. And it's a daunting prospect as well, which puts most people off before they even start writing a book. And some people comment and just say, it's a fantasy. You don't need to do any research. You just write it. You know what I mean? You just think that there's very little involved with writing fantasy. You just make it up on the spot, which isn't the case at all, is it?
You could give it a, you could try. I'm just not sure that readers would necessarily love what you've created, unfortunately. You know, people, there's almost a space where you can go too far in how you've made something up. You go into a space that is too alien to people, that they can't enjoy it, they can't connect to it. And science is a fantastic way of grounding people. It gives people a knowledge area that they already feel a connection with, that then gives them almost a handhold to get them into your story.
Yeah. So what's the relationship with science and magic in particular? Because this magic systems are probably one of the defining features of fantasy. But it does seem to be quite at odds. The beauty of magic, isn't it, is the spontaneity of it. And the sort of the mystery. And when you look at science, as you say, we're looking at defining things. So what's the relationship there?
I really like that you've asked this question, because it's been on my mind so much since I started this YouTube channel. And I think the connection there is that it's almost like a spectrum. And at some point, you will always go from the science to where the magic takes over. Now, where on that spectrum you go is up to you. But the point is that the science can help make the magic feel more real. So I did this recently in an inheritance of magic video on the channel. And that was really fascinating because, you know, if you look at, just ask yourself the question of, okay, well, if magic is inherited, then how is it inherited? Is it that it's passed down on the Y chromosome? So it goes from fathers to sons. And that gives you an interesting mechanism. So you can just say it is a magic gene there, and then that's all that you need to say, and people will accept that because it is fantasy. At the end of the day, people understand that at some point the magic does take over. But then you could also ask, well, I want it to go from mother to daughter, you know, how would I do that? And you can't do that genetically with the X chromosome, because that would also, you know, there's also a chance of that going to the sun that way. But what you could do is consider doing it in like the mitochondrial DNA, which does get passed from mother to daughter. It also gets passed from mother to son, but he doesn't have the mitochondria. This is the whole thing. I'm getting really into the science here, but screw that away. That's for the videos. For right now, the point is that you just need to think about it on this spectrum of where you want your magic to take over. And that's when, you know, it can be at any point. You know, are you talking about, you know, the magical creatures that you've created? You're like, well, this is a lion, but it is able to fly. So then you start asking, well, what mechanisms could that be possible with? You know, is it actually that it does have, you know, this ability? Maybe it does have super strength. Or are you thinking of an underlying biology to it? You know, there's lots of questions you can ask yourself.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And I like the way you said, I think when you're trying to explain magic systems, like, I think it helps if you, obviously depends on the point of view telling the story from, but I think if you say it's a limited perspective, first person, you can sort of get away with it, can't you, a bit more in terms of not explaining things, because that particular character or that group of characters doesn't fully understand, or they only understand up to a certain point, like you say, and the rest is just magic. So,
well, that's a really interesting point, because it's about where your world has got up to scientifically. So, you know, I was talking there about the inheritance of magic, but you could have a world where they don't know about DNA. They've never had a Watson and a Crick of their own. science reference there. And so they don't understand what's going on. So what they do is instead they just know that there's something happening there. It's hand wavy. And actually the inheritance mechanism, that's for you as the author to know but not show. It's the whole iceberg principle when it comes to your world building. Of there's a lot more that we know as authors that we don't actually share with the readers because we know that bogs down the story. It's just there as a guide for you, and it has a realistic feel to it that means that readers can follow. They know the characters might not know, but they go, oh, I know, and it helps them understand. And I find that really useful. And I think that the way that what you need to really consider to make sure you're doing this is to ask yourself, where scientifically has my world got up to? You know, there's some absolutely fantastic resources out there about how our scientific principles, our technological expertise has changed over the years to allow us to be as scientifically advanced as we are. So I'm talking the development of lenses that then meant that microscopes could be developed, that then meant that we could see microorganisms. And if we hadn't been able to do that, then the concept of germs and infections, we still wouldn't have that. So when it comes to maybe say you have a fantasy disease in your world, you know, do you not have lenses? Do you not have microscopes? Because then your people maybe wouldn't be able to know that this is a disease. They could misattribute it to miasma, bad air. You know, there's a lot of ways you can use this to inspire your worlds.
Yeah, that's a really good way of putting it there. And like you said, once you start examining these things, you just end up looking at more and more and more.
Yeah.
Which is the danger. And one thing that when you were talking there, an idea came to me about particularly like science in the medieval period.
Mm.
Like a lot of science was done in the name of God. So they were all trying to like prove or like understand why certain things were as they are, but it was all, like I say, all done in the name of God. So an interesting relationship, I don't know if you've ever come across this, is like science, like sort of people who serve magic as sort of law masters, basically trying to understand the principles behind it and how it works, essentially. Would you class that would be a form of science, wouldn't it?
It would. And the crazy thing is, I'm pretty sure it was a form of science in our own world, because like you said, like there's a lot from medieval times that actually, if you wrote that in a story, that would be considered fantasy. You know, there's people who, you know, we have people who convince themselves that magic was like a gift from the gods, and like, alchemy, the turning of metal into gold, other metals into gold.
Yeah.
You know, that the thinking behind that was, you know, it's still that there was a God principle involved. And I think that's something that we have in our world. You can draw on those examples even. And if you just want to rationalize, you're doing it.
Yeah. Was it Francis Bacon? Was he the crazy alchemist? Is that, am I getting the name?
No. No. Was he an alchemist? Maybe. I don't know.
Jack of all trades, maybe. Do you know of any good examples of stories featuring like magic systems and also like a bit of science involved as well?
Oh, I mean, the go-to for stories featuring a sciencey-based magic system would be, Brandon Sanderson. That's where his hard magic comes from. He's creating more rules, and I think that's the point. Where the magic takes over. And on the spectrum, so if you have you are a person with a staff and therefore you have magic, you know, that's one end of the spectrum of that's very soft magic-y, so because there's fewer rules.
Yeah.
And then if you have the other end of the spectrum where there's lots of rules, so in Sanderson's world, you know, allomancy, you've got lots of different metals. This metal does this metal does that, in this quantity it does that. That's a rule-based magic system where you're applying a lot of our reality to what is possible. At some point the magic does take over, but the magic takes over a lot later, and so that's what gives his magic that hard feel to it.
That's a really good example.
Yeah.
I can't think of there's another example. Have you ever heard James Barclay?
No. Who's he?
James Barclay, he's a British fantasy writer. I think he was president of the British Fantasy Society for a while. But he wrote a series called Chronicles of the Raven, and the Raven were like a band of mercenaries, like the best mercenaries, sort of a bit like Kings of the Wild. I don't know if you've read that.
Yeah, no, I've read Queens of the Wild. No, yeah.
But in magic, wielders there have to sort of recharge their abilities by connecting with things that are alive around them, or they just meditate. So it's a recharge by sort of putting the hands in the ground and sort of drawing energy from the earth, if you get me. Which I thought was quite cool, and he never really explained it. It was sort of left. So well, yeah, that would be like soft magic, wouldn't it? So you wouldn't.
I mean, it feels like it's close to being hard magic. If he then had consequences, then that would have shifted it, I think, into hard magic. I don't know because I've not read the book, but if you're drawing energy from the earth, well, the idea that this energy is maybe just infinite, like you're not damaging the area that you're drawing the energy from, then that would be very soft magic. That's just magic taking over. But if you have that he's that the people by doing this, that they are killing the plant life around them, that the area becomes barren and you can't grow things on it, the energy is depleted, then that would be a more hard magic system because the consequences have taken over.
Yeah, that's a really good distinguishing point. Yeah, nice one. So I think that was some really good points there. Thanks so much, Rachel, again, for stopping by the Tool Shed and sharing your wisdom.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me. I love being on the show. It's great.
Where can we find out a bit more about you?
Oh, you can find me on, I have a website, just type in Rachel Emmershaw. I'm sure all of this will come up. I had to include a middle name because there are like about a million other Rachel Shaws in the world. It's very competitive being a Rachel Shaw. But yeah, you can also find me on YouTube. On my YouTube channel is called Science and Fantasy. So yeah, check me out there.
Fantastic. And Rachel will be back next time. We're going to be looking at evolution and how we can use the principles of evolution to shape and inspire new fantasy worlds and ideas. So thanks.
Stand aside,
everyone. Yeah.
Stand aside, cool. Dragons. They're going to make something new. It's going to be good.
Speak to you next time.
Bye.
A big thank you to Rachel for sharing her scientific insights there. If you'd like to find out more about Rachel and her awesome YouTube channel, just see the link in the description. I have a few bits of news and announcements to share with you now. But first, I wanted to ask for your opinions on an article I read this week in the Guardian newspaper. I think it was published a while ago, but I came across it then. I shared it in our writing group and it sparked a really interesting debate. And the article is called A Dirty Secret, You Can Only Be a Writer If You Can Afford It by Lynn Steger-Strong. And it explores the issue of how low the pay is for writers and whether it's possible to earn a decent living at all. It examines how in days of old, writers had sponsors who believed in them and chose to support them. Now, to a certain extent, I do think there's some truth in this. While writing, for me, it's definitely one of the most universal things in the world. It's accessible to everybody. But being a professional writer can be quite difficult to achieve without the ability to fund all that free time you need to write, edit, research, and get good enough, essentially, to secure a big deal so that you can fund yourself. And then throw into the mix the competitiveness of writing. Really, when you look at it, the odds are stacked against a lot of writers who only have a few hours or someone who doesn't have the financial freedom to give up the job. And like, I know this from first-hand experience because I'm from a working class background and I've had to work hard throughout my life to achieve things, while at the same time I've seen other people get things handed, or the same things handed them to them on a plate, and it can be demoralizing. How are you meant to get there yourself? But I choose to use that not as a hindrance, but as a fuel for determination to succeed, to prove that I can do it. And that's what I should suggest for you to do too, if you ever feel like this, because there are other ways to earn a full-time living from writing nowadays without big traditional publishing deals and those Netflix deals. And that's what I'm trying to do now. I'm trying to set up a business, a writing business that generates income from multiple sources. And I'm going to share everything I learn on my podcast and on this podcast and on my blog as well. So do stick around. You're going to learn a lot. So I'd like to hear from you now. What do you think about this idea that you need the sort of financial freedom in order to write? Please write in with your comments at thefantasywriterstoolshed@gmail.com, and I'll share some of them in the next episode. And feel free to join our writing groups as well, Facebook and Discord. Link is in the description below. We're having a good chat about it at the moment. Now, I'd like to just say a quick congratulations to following writers on their recent successes. Brandy Marks, well done on the release of Heaven's Redemption, book 2 in the Lucifer Unbound series. It sounds very interesting indeed. Brandy's already started work on book 3 as well, so if you're a fast reader, this one's for you. Well done to David McTaggart on the great progress made on his first fantasy novel, Paths to Redemption. It sounds like a wordy one, and you've got a lot of editing to go, I know, but it can be tough in them editing phase. I know that from experience, so yeah, I'm sure stick with it and look forward to reading it when it comes out. And lastly, congratulations to David Donaghy on the release of his free series of new game books called Icon of Death, in which you have to deliver a dangerous package. It sounds really interesting, and you can download it for free via the website DriveThru, which is thrurpg.com. Now it's time to have a little look at book reviews. If you've published a book before, it doesn't matter if it's self-published or if you've got a deal the traditional route, you will appreciate the importance of book reviews. They are vital to marketing and promoting a book. And the main reason why is because it helps overcome psychological blocks that potential readers can experience. These blocks are also known as objections. So when it comes to buying things, we do this all the time. I am awful for it. What we do is look for reasons not to purchase it. I literally talk myself out of things. I'll be set on buying something, and then when it actually comes to doing it, I talk myself out of it. And this would be classed as an objection. When a reader picks up a book, we as writers, and also marketers, because we've got to think like this now in this modern age of writing, we need to defeat any objections that a potential reader may face. And one thing that I look for, if I'm unsure about something, I will turn to the reviews. And this is one of the most persuasive things we can do, is to show them what other people think. Give them an insight into the minds of other readers. And this can only be done through reviews. So this is why it's so, so important. And the publishing industry recognises this. So months before a book is due to be released, it'll be bundled up and sent out to advanced readers. Often these are influential book reviewers, and the goal is to gather book reviews and editorials as you motor towards publication day. Because the more reviews a book gets in that period, the more momentum it builds. And then as you've got all these reviews, the easier it is to promote and sell that book. So there are challenges, and while traditional publishers hold the financial clout and the broad networks to get their books out before reviewers, there are lots of ways that any writer can achieve a good amount of reviews. Now, a starting point would be my list of 250 plus book reviewers. You can download a copy via the link in the description, and also view the list via the link to my website. I've spent countless hours looking for book reviewers. I've looked on the web, social media, spoken to people in bookshops, anything really, just to get details down, anyone who'd be interested in reviewing the book. And I had this list just for my own use. So I decided to publish it for everyone else's benefit. And it's one of the most popular pages on my website now. There are other lists out there as well. If you Google list of book reviewers, you'll find other sites. I think Readsy has a pretty big one. Now, there are different approaches. I will come back to free lists and things like that. But just a quick word on paid ones, because it's a growing industry, the paid book review. There are some paid services that are quite well known, like NetGalley, BookSiren, Booksprout. They're all worth checking out just to see if you like the sound of what they offer. But always do your research. Always, you don't want to commit a lot of money to something that isn't guaranteed, I don't think. Like NetGalley is very expensive. I know a lot of reviewers do, especially influential reviewers do review through that platform. I've never tried it, so I'm not going to comment anymore. BookSiren is something I have used. It's pretty good. It's reasonably priced. You only pay for accepted reviews. And I have received some very decent reviews through BookSiren. Booksprout is a similar kind of platform, but I didn't get any reviews, so I can't really speak for its efficacy. And of course, Story Origin. We had creator Evan Gao of Story Origin on the show recently, and Evan has recently improved the review search function, so you can upload a review copy to the website. You can list that book in group promos that are delivered deliberately to book reviewers. And yeah, it's a fantastic way of connecting with book reviewers and getting your book before the eyes of readers. Now, they're all paid for tools. I think they do have free options, some of them as well. So we will stick back towards the free methods now. And another very effective method, which I found a lot of success with when promoting Pariah's Lament, which is to make a list of the books that are similar to your own. Then what I did is Google the title of each of those books with book review in the search as well. And then I'm presented with pages of book review sites and blogs that have reviewed this particular book. So I can then go and have a read of that review, see if the book reviewer would like my book. And if they do, I'll drop them an email or get in touch through the contact form on the website. We'll come to this shortly, but what you can do, make a connection with that reviewer, tell them that you appreciated their review, that you really enjoyed what they said, what their thoughts about the book, and you noticed how similar it was. And if you like this book, then you might like your book. And that is a really good way of narrowing down the focus. And Google, obviously, you get up to 100 results for each title. 10 pages, 10 sites on each page. So, yeah, see how you get on. And, yeah, you might find some good success with it. Another way is Instagram. Now, there's a pretty mega Bookstagram community on there at the moment. It just seems to grow and grow and grow. So what I usually do is a bit of hashtag research. So I'll take something like hashtag Bookstagram, and then I'll look for hashtag book reviews, and then just have a search and see who's posting. Go and have a look at the profile, see what kind of books that that particular reviewer is into. And then if you've got a website through the link on in their description or bio, then you can get in touch with them that way or drop them a message directly through Instagram. So there are a few ways of finding book reviewers. Now, what I'm going to bring in the research that I've, the early results of this research that I've started conducting, which is because some of the questions that I've asked help form your approach to pitching your book to a book reviewer, because that's what you've got to do. You've got to sell your book. Now, I am going to keep this survey open for a little while longer because I want to get more responses and then publish the results in full, because the more people that do fill out the survey and provide their opinions, the more persuasive the research is. So if you are a book blogger, a book reviewer, please see the link in the description and you fill out the form, the survey, and I'll be releasing the results soon. So in the survey, I ask a few questions, and I think each one provides more and more illumination on the process of pitching a book to a book reviewer from the perspective of the reviewer. I'm going to go through the answers to some of the most interesting ones. Not all the questions. Like I say, I will publish the results in full, so don't worry. Now, question one is, on average, how many book review queries do you get each week? Now, firstly, about a third of the reviewers who have responded so far said they get around one or two queries a week. which is lower than what I thought. But a quarter said that they can get up to 10 queries. So that can be as many as 40 a month. The remainder said that they can get as many as 25 a week. That is an awful lot of queries. So what we've got to think about there is that when you do write your query, especially to reviewers who have a big following, think about the competition you could be up against, as well as the volume of emails that the book reviewer has to get through. So be patient, be polite, appreciate their situation, and you've got a better chance of getting a response. Second question I asked is, what attracts you most to a book when reading a query? Now, I've always wondered this more than anything, and no one has ever really been able to give me an answer. And that's why I was so keen to do this research, because it would reveal this answer. And the overwhelming answer so far, with 81% of the vote, is the book's description. And this has to be an incredibly important factor. We can't ignore 81%. Reviewers aren't anywhere near as bothered about the book cover, whether it's had any other reviews, what the reputation of the author is. The description is what matters. So think about that when you're writing your pitches. Next question is, what turns you off a book most of all when reading a query? The leading answer for this one, with 30% of the vote, is that the author has not done any research on the blog or the book reviewer. This is very important. You can't just find the website and head straight to the submissions page or the contact page. You've got to see if that author, that reviewer, is going to be interested. It might take you a bit more time, but you're going to get more results, and that's what you want to focus on. It's not about quantity, it's about conversions, because you're spending your time more wisely. In second place for this question is receiving a generic query. And this sort of ties in with the first one, because if you're just flying through reviews, you're just popping them off. Yeah, book reviewers are going to see through that. You're not going to be able to write a unique query. And something that you can do to make your review pitches more unique is to see if they've reviewed any book similar to yours, or you've seen any particular reviews on their site that you've really enjoyed or bought a book off the back of. Other reasons for this question include not following submission guidelines, always very important. Comparing work to other authors, though I do think that this can be useful. To be honest, this got a very low score, so I'm waiting to see if other people agree as well. And lastly is a weak pitch. Next question we've got, what advice would you give to authors querying book reviewers? Now, there are a few answers here. I'm just going to fly through some of the best ones. Always read bloggers' review policies. Focus on reviewers that read books similar to theirs. Don't be pushy. Provide a paragraph synopsis, the book cover, and details of who your publisher is, if any. They should do research on the blog or the reviewer before submitting a query. Please include a synopsis that is compelling and concise. If a blogger says they don't read a genre your book falls into, please don't send a request and waste both parties' time. This is my favourite one. I think this is one of the most interesting. Keep your book pitches short. Say, here's my book, if you fancy reviewing it, rather than, would you like a copy of this to review? Include a link to the book file in the first email so that the reviewer doesn't have to specifically reply with a request. Basically, don't try to put the reviewer under any obligation. Leave the book on my desk and walk away. Now, this is an interesting one. I'm going to speak a little bit more about that shortly. I'll finish the list first. Take the time to research the person you are contacting, what sort of genre they prefer, and how the book is written. Give them a like or two on social media and converse with them. So here we go, making connections with the reviewer. And we have so many books that we want to read and a limited amount of time. I really appreciate author requests who recognise our time constraints and the commitment we make to them, and take the time to thank us or post comments on our blogs. Personal emails are so wonderful. I love them and they often make my day. But we are trying to build a following too, and authors who comment and share public stories or posts are really, really awesome. Now, that is a really good comment as well. It's so illuminating to what the position of a book reviewer is. And as writers, we need to be working together. We're all in the same industry. We're all in the same boat. We need reviewers as much as reviewers need books to read. So we need to celebrate that. We need to work together. And that's what that last comment really does hammer home. So what can we take from this in summary? First of all, research each and every reviewer. Do they read books similar to yours? Great. If so, research their policies. Can you? Do you think you fit? Are you going to comply with it? If so, submit a query. When you do submit that query, have an interesting description. So think about how you can deliver this in an interesting and compelling way. And as someone who writes a lot of review queries, hearing nothing in response can be quite common. And I love the comment about leave the book on my desk and walk away. So while I'm reluctant to just dish out copies of my book, if it's to a reviewer that I can trust, I am going to trial just sending the copy of the book or maybe a sample. Samples, I think, may be more of an interest than one, because once someone, you're not giving away the full book, you're giving away a small amount that is more secure to your intellectual property. So obviously, if that reviewer starts reading it, they like it, they're going to come back to you and say, I've started reading your book, I'm enjoying it, can I have the rest of it? So there you go, try that. I'm going to trial it myself and I'll let you know. Next is be patient. Refrain from sending chase emails and accept that you may not hear anything at all. Lastly, appreciate this point more than anything else. Book reviewing is built on honesty. Reviews are an honest opinion. If your reviewer doesn't like the book, most of the time they won't leave a review at all. But be prepared to hear things that you don't like. Don't attack the reviewer for sharing their thoughts. Nobody wins and everybody loses in that case. Now, I do wish you the very best of luck on your quest for those elusive reviews. If you have any great tips that you'd like to share with us, please write in to thefantasywriterstoolshed@gmail.com and I'll share any suggestions next time around. I'll also let you know when I publish these results in full. Now I think it's time for a bit of history, and I'm thinking you're going to enjoy this one. It sounds like quite a simple concept, exploring the day-to-day lives of the people of the medieval period, but it's these simple and very small details that I find make the biggest difference, especially when it comes to world building. They can really make your world feel alive. And when I was getting reviews for Pariah's Lament, reviewers were picking out these lovely little details that I added in, and they were saying that these were the sort of things that made the world feel alive and immersive. So this is what I'm trying to help you with today, to give you inspiration, to give you ideas. And to help me do that, I'm thrilled to welcome back our resident historian, Aidan Mathis. Hello and welcome to another instalment of our medieval history exploration with medieval genius, as far as I'm concerned, Aidan Mathis from the Law Lodge podcast. How's it going today, Aidan?
Good. Genius. Woo. Don't inflate my ego too much. I have to tell my old professors about that one.
So we've looked at medieval diseases, and last time we looked at archery as well, which was fascinating. And today we want to carry on sort of dispelling the myths that fantasy writers, well, I suppose not really myths, because you can get away with it in fantasy, but the sort of misrepresentations, particularly if you're writing in a medieval setting. And also to give you ideas as well, because that's one thing that I love, chatting to people who know more about me than these kind of things, because you always get ideas for new stories and stuff like that. So today we're going to talk about medieval life. What was it like for the everyday peasants? Which is something we have touched upon in episode one, when we were talking about hygiene and disease and things like that. And so I just wanted to expand upon that really, and just to get an idea of what it was like on a day-to-day basis, like what kind of jobs people were doing, how would they spend the time. So what was life like in the medieval period for everyday people?
So that's a big question. So I think, I don't know, one way to to talk about that would definitely be to break it up into the early, high, and late medieval periods, because they all had very distinct ways of life. You know, in the early medieval period, you didn't have feudalism yet. You did have a kind of proto-feudalist society, where you did have your king, and then your landed nobility, and then your gentry, your artisans, and your freemen and your serfs. But this was not, it wasn't quite the structured, you know, homage for, you know, the homage for beneficium agreement. You know, you give your oath of homage and you get your land in return, or your status, whatever the king or lord grants you. And, you know, you would have, of course, that was all very legally structured in the high Middle Ages during feudalism. During the early medieval period, if you were a freeman and you lived on a lord's land and they decided to go to war, it was essentially, they came by and said, you have to go to war. Yeah. Like, you know, grab your pitchfork or whatever you got. You're coming with me. You're going to stand behind the professional soldiers and be a body and just be some weight, basically. And then you're just going to, they were basically a dike or a dam trying to prevent the people at the front from getting pushed back too far. You never expected your, in England, they were called the Ferd, F-Y-R-D. You never expected your Ferdmen to fight. You expected them to basically just give you the appearance of numerical superiority, because early medieval combat was very much a morale game. But yeah, so that's, you know, that's kind of how that end of life was structured. In the feudal era, it was a much more voluntary kind of thing. You could obviously be conscripted into service and pressed into service, but it wasn't the way they preferred to do things. They preferred to have a somewhat professional fighting force. So they would go and they would recruit, and you can still obviously call up your Ferd and call up your men and take them to war with you. But it was so disruptive to society that they didn't really do it that often. And then by the high Middle Ages, you had battles being fought, or by the late Middle Ages, you had battles primarily being fought by knights on horseback and, you know, highly skilled archers and pikemen. But that's obviously the warfare way of life and how that changed over time. In the early Middle Ages, when it came to, for example, you know, agrarianism and the farming societies, what you had was basically you had outside the nobility, for the average person's life, you would have three main types of people. And those would be serfs. So serfs and slaves, people who were, you know, not free, who were tied to the land or tied to bondage. And then you would have freemen, who were not nobility, but they did have, you know, the ability to move as they pleased. They could get up from one town and move to the next without anybody batting an eyelash. And then you had the craftsmen, the artist class. And these would be people like blacksmiths and tanners and, you know, some lesser extent scribes and things like that. Yeah. Those people would all be usually living in the cities. They'd be a little bit better paid, and they would usually have patrons. So they would have people kind of sponsoring them.
Yeah.
You know, you obviously might have your, you know, village blacksmith, but they were also, everybody was going to pitch in to buy stuff from them. They were somebody who worked in their finished goods rather than their raw goods. And so that's kind of how that class of medieval society was broken up. And I guess the best way to break this up is into the three main classes of medieval life, which was the labor class, the priestly class, and the labor class, the clergy, and the warriors.
Yeah.
Those were the three main classes of medieval life. And you had your laborers were probably 90% of the population. And that was everyone from slaves up through, you know, priests. And those were all people, or sorry, not priests, slaves up to craftsmen. And then you had your, so that was the laborators, is the Latin word for it. And then you had your orators, who were the speakers, the priests. And those were the clergy, you know, everything from your local deacon on up to an archbishop, up to the Pope. Yeah. And those were people who, again, had a much different structure, which actually, little known fact about this, and something that I find interesting to bring out at parties, but apparently I'm the only one who finds it interesting, is that the clergy, the monastic system, was based off of the Roman military. So the schools were based off of schule, which were the way that the Romans would set up their, basically their barracks and their fortresses. Was they would have these very specifically planned out things, and they would have, you know, at this time you do this and at this time you do this. And the monks based their lives around this Roman military rule. And that's where you get the term rule, like the Benedictine rule, the Dominican rule. And it was, I believe, the Benedictines, but it might have been the Franciscans, who had the two primary goals of their order were to eliminate leprosy, which they actually succeeded at doing, and to convert all of the Muslims to Christianity, which they did not succeed at doing. Did not succeed there. That was, did not go well for them. But they spent their lives essentially doing scientific research, preserving records, obviously preaching, collecting donations for the church. But that's one of the other grave misconceptions about the medieval period that a lot of people have, is that it was the scientific dark age. And in reality, it was actually, there's this idea that comes really out of the Renaissance period and in Italy, that the Catholic Church was anti-science. And it wasn't. It actually was, it was the primary patron of scientific research from essentially the year 500 up until about 1500. So for about 1,000 years, the Catholic Church was the only organized, you know, body funding science. And most of the science they were funding was medical and agricultural. But, you know, those were the two things that mattered the most at the time. They didn't really have a need for astronomy. They didn't have a need for physics yet. They were focused on kind of those lower facets of Maslow's hierarchy, you know, food and shelter. They were like, you know, how do we keep people healthy? How do we keep them fed? How do we keep them sheltered? How do we do that? And they did a very good job of it. And you might be able to argue that had they not been there, then you would have the same growth. But they're, you know, it was at the time very much a force for good. For all the bad that, you know, came with it, they did do a lot of good in that respect. But most of the people who were doing scientific research at the time would have been monks and priests, because that was the only class where you could really manage to do that, because they had the funding, they had the backing, and they didn't have the obligations that your average freeman would have to farm and pay taxes. And they didn't have the military obligations that your warrior class had, the milites class. And that would be the final class to discuss, would be those warriors, those knights, your lords, your kings. And that's not to say that bishops and, you know, priests never fought. There were plenty of bishops who led armies. If you go back and you look at, there's medieval woodcuttings that show bishops in full medieval armor with that big bishop hat on. Yes. It's hilarious. But that's where the bishop position in chess comes from. Like, it's because, and if you look at a bishop, a chess piece, it looks like a bishop's hat. That's what it is. And it's because you would have bishops commonly leading armies to war. And bishops would be the head of a bishopric, which would be a, quite literally, a region, a province governed by a bishop. And these were, you know, to certain extents, in some cases, independent countries run by bishops or archbishops. And this led to tons of controversy between the milites, the noble class, and the clergy and the church. For example, the investiture controversy, which was between Henry the IV, I want to say, the Holy Roman Emperor, versus Pope Gregory the VII. If I think I'm getting my Gregory's right here. Oh, and the argument was over who gets to invest bishops, who gets to say, yes, this is the person who's going to govern this land. Because in many cases, bishops were governing land that was technically ruled by a secular king. So the secular king obviously wanted his guy to be the bishop, but the Pope wanted his guy to be the bishop. And this actually ended up being resolved through an agreement brokered by Henry II of England. But it led to almost war between the Catholic Church and the Holy Roman Empire. At one point, the entirety of the Holy Roman Empire was excommunicated, like, for a brief period. But then they realized that they didn't have the military power to back that. So that final class, the Milites class, that was very much a warrior aristocracy. And this dates back very far into European culture. It was very much a Germanic and Celtic concept. The Romans kind of did their own thing. They and the Greeks had more of this idea of a citizen soldiery, a citizen army that was led by the best person. It was a meritocratic system, whereas the Northern European system was very much more class-based. But that warrior class would essentially, in exchange for protecting the people, would collect taxes from them. And, you know, obviously they wouldn't always do the best things with those taxes. They wouldn't always impose fair tax rates, but that was the way that society functioned. And you would start usually at like the lowest rung of that if you were in a noble family. And this is another misconception, is you could work your way up. So your father could have been a serf, but if he amassed enough money that he decided, you know what, I am going to pay to have this family take my son on as a page at, you know, age 6, age 7, and then they're going to go on to become a squire one day, and eventually they will become a knight. And then, you know, maybe they're going to become a landed knight. And then once you're a landed knight, you have a little bit more to work with. And you're not going to ever be a lord, but your son might be a minor lord. And then, you know, over time, he might amass wealth. And if he amasses wealth, he might be able to buy land from other lords. And then he's going to become a major lord. And then eventually, you become lord of a big enough region, you're going to become a prince. And if you become a prince, it's not that far of a jump to become a king. So that's kind of how that was structured and how you could move up through the ranks of society over several generations of a family. Of course, there's also intermarrying and the right political alliances. And, you know, maybe you find a particular usurper's claim to the throne to be strong, or at least his chances of successfully taking over that country to be strong, and you side with him. And then you end up jumping a few steps because you were on the right side of the right rebellion. But that was, and that's the sect of society that gets talked about the most, I think, in fantasy literature and in fantasy media, is the military class. And it gets, I think that peasant hero gets romanticized a lot, but that was something that could happen. You know, the ransom system, the way that it worked was, if you captured somebody, it wasn't your lord that got the ransom, it was you. So if you were a peasant archer serving, if you grew up, you know, in York, and you served the Duke of York as an archer, and you managed to, you know, reach up with your bowstring and whip a knight off of his horse and take his weapons, you took him hostage, you get all the money from selling off his armor and selling him back to his family, and you can go from being a lowly peasant bowman to being a very, very wealthy man in a very short period of time. And it wasn't common that specifically happened, but it was possible. Yeah. So these stories of these, you know, common rabble becoming lords overnight aren't totally far-fetched, probably a little bit off base. Like, you know, they probably wouldn't get accepted by the nobility, but that could happen, that you could become very wealthy very quickly. And once you were very wealthy, it was only a matter of making yourself appear noble over time. And that could be, you know, marrying your children to the right families and getting the right priest to write the right history of you and all of that. But that was kind of how life worked. And, you know, the everyday life of a peasant, a freeman, was, you know, you get up early, you work in the fields until all the work for the day is done. You know, you go back home, you have a glass of ale, you go to the tavern and listen to, you know, some troubadours who are passing through town play, you know, you go to bed, and you wake up and you do it again the next day. And then Sunday's your day off.
Yeah.
You know, and it was, it generally was that men would do the physical labor and women would run the household. So women were actually generally the ones who did most of the math in your average family. And that didn't really stop with your average family. That got up to, like, you know, the nobility. Women were, there's another idea that women were not educated in the Middle Ages. No, it's that nobody was educated in the Middle Ages. The few people who would be educated, 90% of them were priests. The remaining 10% were the children of nobles. And women and men would both get tutored. They would both have private tutors who would teach them, you know, here's how you read, here's how you write, here's how you do basic math, basically all the liberal arts education. You had the Tribidium and the Quadridium, and these were the three basic, I think it's grammar, arithmetic, and I can't remember what the third one is, but then the Quadridium was the other four liberal arts that you usually would be the next level of schooling. So you would learn the basics and then you would go on to learn the more intermediate levels. And then if you wanted to specialize and go to college, the earliest colleges existed from the 11th century. So, I mean, Oxford is older than most countries. In fact, if you go by countries' current constitutional documents, then Oxford is older than every country, which is fascinating. That is incredible. Yeah. But, you know, that's this. And that was the other thing about medieval education was, you know, it was, the way that colleges came to be was you would have groups of noblemen who would say, I want to learn about this, and this person is the most well-versed on that, so we're going to come together and pull together our money, and we're going to pay that person to come here and teach us what they know. And that was how college began. Yeah. Now, I don't know quite how things are over in the UK, but in the US, we have gone a little bit away from that, and colleges have gotten too big for their britches.
Same over here, yeah.
Yeah. So now, you know, you go and you're like, here's $120,000. And they're like, okay, here's a list of textbooks that you need to buy. Not that we're going to give you that you need to buy. And yeah, we're basically going to charge you for us to grade your work. And that's what school is in the United States now.
Same, yeah.
Yeah, it's part of why I don't really want to be a professor anymore.
You don't need to be anyway.
This kind of thing, I think, is the future of education.
Yeah, it's accessible, you know, to everybody. You don't need to charge people.
Yeah, and if you want to, you know, I think it should go back to kind of the way it started back then. You know, if you want to learn something, if you find somebody's point of view interesting and you want to learn more about it, you know, toss them a couple bucks to help them pay for their next meal. And, you know, sit and listen to what they have to say. I think with the internet and information being so available, I think that we have a chance to go back to, you know, an oddly enlightened period of history when the students were the ones running the classroom and, you know, in charge of all of that.
Feels like we've gone backwards.
Yeah, a little bit. But yes, I mean, that's how college began. But yeah, the Middle Ages, you know, education was not widespread, but the people who were educated, it transcended, you know, all sorts of class boundaries. And, you know, if you were born a peasant, but you decided to go into the priesthood, you were going to be educated. So if you were born a noble and, you know, had the attention span for it, you were going to be educated. So it was a very interesting period of time, and opportunities were provided from unlikely places, I would say.
Yeah. I think what we've learned again then is that things aren't always what the portrayed. It's very different, and like obviously people just think peasants were farmers, and a lot of fantasy tends to follow that kind of the poor peasant orphan farmer boy or girl who rises up and has some sort of magical gift, and there we go.
But Joan of Arc.
Yeah, we could talk a whole other episode.
Yeah, about Joan of Arc,
but we won't.
Oh boy,
we'll leave it.
But we won't.
Yeah. Aidan, thanks again so much for sharing your wisdom. It's been fascinating. Tell us how we can find you.
Oh yeah, you can find me at The Lore Lodge on YouTube and Instagram, and The Aidan Mattis on pretty much everything else.
Fantastic. Thanks again, and we'll be back next week with a look at medieval warfare and battles.
My favorite.
I love it. I can't wait. Big thank you to Aidan there. And in our next episode on the 14th of December, we'll be talking more about something I'm very excited about, medieval warfare. So thank you so much for listening today. I hope you learned something new. And like I said, we'll be back on the 14th of December. The year is nearly over. I can't really believe it. It's all been a bit of a blur, to be honest, the last 2 years. But next episode, we're going to be taking a look at Greek mythology and medieval warfare, like I said, which is a very festive topic indeed. And if you did enjoy today's episode, please consider subscribing or following. Leave us a quick review with your thoughts, or share this show with anyone you think may be interested. It really does mean a lot. Don't forget to join our writing community too. The link is in the description. And be sure to check out our Patreon page for access to some very cool and helpful fantasy-related resources. So until next time, happy scribbling.